Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Well, this week it's been announced that the USDA will start doling out $4.7 billion of the $12 billion that's been promised to U.S. farmers for food commodities that have been impacted by recent geopolitical trade wars. Now, there's also been a plan to buy back $1.2 billion of food by the USDA, which has been earmarked for federal nutrition programs for kids and low-income Americans. Well, as of now, where that food goes and who will assist is still void of details. But specifically for the direct payouts from the government, it will go to farmers of mostly soybeans, corn, cotton, dairy, hogs, sorghum, and wheat products that have been affected by the retaliatory tariffs put on U.S. imports by different countries. To give you some context and some information around that, about $559 million to pork, $93 million to apples, $85 million to pistachios are some of the examples of what have been promised to our farmers. But this doesn't seem to be good enough to counteract our new posturing plan for international exposure. For instance, the $127 million that's set aside for subsidizing dairy is estimated to cover only 10% of the losses for our dairymen and women that have felt with these newly minted international tariffs placed on their products. And for most of these, it's obviously centralized of exports into China, all commodity goods. The National Corn Growers Association said that they've understood from the beginning that this aid package would neither make farmers whole nor offset long-term erosion of export markets. But even with lowered expectations, it's disappointing that this plan does not consider the extent of the damage done to corn farmers. Over the past decade, being held victim to commodity bubbles has seemed hard enough for most domestic farmers. Now, when you throw in a foreign affairs flexing competition by a guy who doesn't seem to have the stature to compete on the stage, it's a tough realization that sometimes your prize pig just doesn't deliver at the show. So, this is concerning, obviously, and what we try to take a look at this from Sourcing Matters' perspective is this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to start looking at solutions of change, and this is an opportunity for us to reevaluate our approach for growing food. This disruption to the apple cart is an opportunity for us to look differently at who we're growing food for and how it benefits the producers themselves, their communities, and the country's regenerative natural resources, and obviously the consumers that they serve. So I'm going to chalk this up to a master plan by our administration to invest in these undervalued natural resources, to look long-term at jobs of tomorrow and in better food for the health of our people and to move us more regenerative in lockstep with natural order. Well, that might be a positive perspective on things. And as I read this morning, the 2018 majority-sponsored farm bill has proposed an $800 million cut to conservation programs. That logic may be hard-pressed, but that's okay. We're going to look at this again as an opportunity. And so maybe not what the guys that they're looking at here, and better yet, looking at it differently of how we can control that is to start getting out there and voting in November for things that matter to you. So if you're an environmentalist, if you care about food, if you care about local jobs, here's a chance to look at this differently. And that parlays nicely into our conversation today, where we're bringing in for a conversation a guest to the show who's actually a leader in moving us towards more regenerative, who by hell or high water has committed to investing in animal well-being for the betterment of planetary and human health, and as a financial landscape of production continues to evolve in real time, he sees an opportunity for sustainable business for future food, and stability that others will eventually follow. Today, we welcome Ridge Shin, CEO of Big Picture Beef. Hey, Ridge.
Hey, Aaron.
Thanks for joining.
Great to be here.
You came out to our studio in Cambridge, Massachusetts, from Hardwick, Massachusetts. So thank you for making the time.
Absolutely.
So, Rich, let's jump into this right away. I kind of set this conversation up that you've been at this for quite a while, and you are well known. Anyone that I talk to in around the U.S., around pasture-based models, around regenerative best practice, when I talk about from the Northeast, I always hear, "Do you know Ridge Shin?"
Right.
Yes, I do. He's the man. I've learned a great deal from him. So let's talk about what your background and how we've gotten to Big Picture Beef. So I'm just going to read a quick introduction about Big Picture Beef, and I'm going to hand it over to you to tell us a little bit about how we got here and what we can look forward to in the future. So founded in 2015, based out of Hardwick, Massachusetts, Big Picture Beef's mission is to establish an environmentally sustainable and economically viable model for producing beef through managed grazing, no feedlots, no grain, ever. We envision a system that produces healthy animals, healthy food, healthy soils, and fair wages for farmers. So please, Ridge, tell us more.
Okay. Well, it's been a long odyssey to get here through, a big learning curve for the past 20 years. We've figured out now how to find the right kind of cattle for grass, how to grow grass, how to grow grass with good nutrition for cattle, how to make cattle fat on grass, how to get cattle processed. And really what we come up against is the next big challenge is how to explain to the consumer what the heck is going on. So grass-fed beef is popular. Out of the $100 million worth of beef sold in this country, $4 billion is grass-fed. Of that $4 billion, $3 billion comes from elsewhere, Uruguay, Australia, Ireland. So only 1% is U.S. One of our big challenges now with the customer is getting them to understand what a difference it makes to buy beef grown in our region. So, and one of the big problems today, a company can bring a container load of meat from Uruguay, land it in the port of Boston, cut it up in Sutton, Mass., and label it product of USA. That's the law. So it's a huge problem for the consumer to figure out what the true story is. But the impacts, if the consumers will vote with their dollars, I mean, go vote in the election, but vote with your dollars. What you buy has huge ramifications for the rural economy. Every dollar that comes back to the farm gate, multiplies seven times through the rural economy. So that's our game, to try and get the product available to the customer, explain what it is, why it's important, and make it available. One of my friends, Lisa Sebesta, we spent a lot of time talking about this whole field, and she said, "Well, Ridge, how are you guys going to compete against Australia? Australia's got cheaper product." And I said, "Lisa, the reality is Australia can't even put a team in our gymnasium. They're not here. They cannot put carbon in the soil. They cannot fix the water cycle. They cannot create jobs because they're thousands of miles away." So that's our opportunity. That's a true story, but explain that to people who really don't know the difference between a cow and a pig and a chicken. That's our challenge.
It is a challenge, and I understand and correlating that. But it seems like we do have a more engaged consumer that is looking for these things, or at least
absolutely
tip of the iceberg here, right? We're looking at it and maybe coaxing them along. And we've seen it happen in other food categories. And we've talked about this with our guests, too, but I'd love to get your context on this. So, expert in producing great beef the right way. And we'll get back into that. And I like how you fast forward by the it's cattle, grass, and fattening them the right way after 25 years of doing or 30 years doing it the right way. We're now there, but we'll get back into that in a bit. But let's talk about the consumer, the change agent of the consumer here. Should consumers expect to see more evolutions in this marketplace? So just like with grass-fed or any kind of beef, we've seen something around aging. There's certain classifications of animal species specific that there's certain nomenclature, some values associated to it. But when we look at other food categories, as mentioned, like wine, cheese, coffee, where there's nuance like terroir or seasonality or regional or place matters, are we going to get to that point with beef? Can we get there?
Well, I think that's... eventually, perhaps. I think a lot of it is somewhat, it's a great story, like terroir. You know, this animal ate something or that. The animal lived for 2 years. When did it eat that? Did it eat only that? No, no way. So to get that to add up, the big problem with grass-fed beef is many people are raising grass-fed beef, which is certifiably grass-fed, never ate any grain, but it also is not fat it's not tasty, has off flavors. And part of that is because it's the real skill in grass-fed beef is to get enough energy for the cattle to get fat. And very few people are doing that. Very few programs understand it, and then very few know how to do it. So that's the big challenge, having a great piece of grass-fed beef. You know, I'll give you an example. Dan Barber, Stone Barn Center, you know, has embraced this for years. About 2 or 3 years ago, I called Dan, who was a friend. I said, Dan, I got to send you some samples. He said, well, you're not close enough. I said, just want to try them, not selling it. So he tried it. He was blown away. He said, this got to be one of the best steaks I ever had. How did you do it? And I said, well, it's about the energy in the grass, Dan. You know, the top third of the grass is energy. You have to move the cattle so they have energy all day long. So he had me come down to the restaurant, talk to his people. He had me go to his farm in Great Barrington, talk to his farmers. But he was blown away. He said, Rich, you know, I've embraced this farm-to-table thing since the beginning. Grass-fed beef is the right thing. But my experience is intermittent at best. Sometimes it's tolerable. Sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it's terrible. But I know I should do it. So to be presented with a great, tasty, fat piece of grass-fed beef is unique. And that's the challenge. And, you know, people have embraced it for all the right reasons. But you're only going to buy that so many times if it's unpalatable.
Yeah.
So if you get one to blow you away, it's like, fantastic. And that's what we're finding. People taste it. Wow, this is good. You know, because of the fats.
Yeah.
It's all about the fats in the meat, which are a result of the energy.
Interesting. So it's a systems thinking approach that benefits us because it just tastes better. So, and it's a different operating system because when you stick an animal in a feedlot environment and you just give them corn, well, obviously they're going to marbleize the meat. It's going to be a quick shots of energy. It's the same thing with us when we eat
right.
corn syrup or corn or whatever that high impact sugar or amino acid may be, right? So now we've got something where we're looking at it of this is the natural forage of a ruminant, right? And they can do well by knowing where the food's coming from and by having an expert working with them. So let's jump in a bit more into that if we could, because the no doubt one of the misnomers of grass-fed beef that you touched on is that you can't marbleize it. It tastes bad. It's tough, right? You get it in the mouth, it's tough.
And also the big one that you see on every website, well, here's the two things. Every website, look at the pictures. This is the best picture. And look at the grass. Most websites, it's like a golf course. There's no grass. How could they be eating grass?
Right.
But the other thing on every website is it's lean. The reality is, if it's not been fattened, it is lean. And, you know, I got into this with Lauren Cordain, the paleo guy, and he was giving a talk, and he said paleo people went to great extent to kill these aurochs with wooden spears. And he said they were going after the lean meat. And I put my hand up, and I said, they're going after the fat. He said, lean meat. I said, fat. I said, all you got is the bones. How do you know what they're going after? And he said, well, all the research shows grass-fed beef is lean. I said, well, all the research is wrong. And I work with Susan Duckett at Clemson University. How they do the research is they take 100 head, they split the 100, 50 on forage, 50 on grain. When the 50 on grain get fat, they kill them all and compare. And guess what? The ones on forage are lean in comparison. So I said, Susan, you got to let the ones on forage get fat and then compare them. So that'll throw the research off. I said, why bother doing it? You know? But if you look at all the research, it's done like that.
Yeah.
So thousands of dollars have been spent. Well, yes, it does take longer to get them fat on forage.
Yeah.
But you can get them fat. So, we've sent samples to Susan Duckett, 8 samples, you know, 8 random animals, and they come out choice and prime, one select. And she said, this is incredible, Rich. These are fat. And yet I know they didn't eat any grain because the omega-6 omega-3 ratio is 1.2 to 1. She said, well, it gives. I said, well, we made them fat.
Yeah.
We gave them enough energy.
Yeah.
But it's a big management challenge. You have to have, you know, grass like this. The grass, it's tall. You can't do it on grass like a golf course.
You just mentioned what I was leading up to, which I think is an excellent point for our consumers to know, which is the health profile for ourselves, the omega-3, omega-6 ratio, the oleic acids, proven different when an animal's eating its proper forage compared to when it's eating something on grain.
Absolutely.
Right. So what have we seen for research there? And is that just the beginning? Are we just tip of the iceberg of looking into that?
There's tons of research. It's been around for a long time.
Okay.
When you feed grain, you get a higher ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. So you get 10 omega-6 to 1 omega-3. When you feed a grass-only diet, you get like 1 to 1 or close to 1 to 1, 1.2 to 1.
Right.
And that ratio is perfect for human health. So all of the bad rap that red meat has for human health comes from the omega-6, which comes from the grain.
Right.
So there it is. You know, you remove it. Now all of a sudden you have a perfect ratio.
Yep.
And now we've gotten over the prejudice against fat. We know that these fats, some people say bad fats, good fats. Omega-6 is bad, omega-3 is good. They're both EFAs. They're both essential fatty acids, mm-hmm. essential for brain function. We need them in the right ratio. And you can get that ratio in grass-fed. So. Mm.
And just to get some context to that, the one-to-one ratio is similar to what we get from salmon.
Precisely.
Right? So
Precisely.
We actually have a red meat, beef,
right.
that is heart healthy. That is
Precisely.
That is good for us. And let's jump into the next step of that, which is good for the planet.
Absolutely.
Right? So we've chatted about this with some other guests, but you know, for someone that's in the field every day dealing with this and also bringing this product to market, you have the vertical stack, you have the vertical integration of the full program, and I want to talk about Big Sky and how you're looking at this, but if you could share with the audience, how does rotational grazing, how does putting animal back out on pasture, what is this systems approach that gets carbon back into the soil from on the hoof?
Right. Well, to give you a quick picture of it, okay, envision the prairie. Everybody knows there were deep, deep, deep soils on the prairie, which we since have plowed up and turned into the Dust Bowl, but there were the deep soils. How did that happen? So was the prairie growing and the buffalo parachuted in? Were the buffalo walking around on a dry lot and the prairie parachuted in? No, it's a symbiosis of the large herbivore with the sun, photosynthesis, carbon. And that's how the soils were built. And we have found that we can do it rapidly in 3 years, 5 years, not eons. We can put down, like for instance, Mark, one of my finishing farms in Vermont, he's recorded in the last over about 7 or 8 years, 12.5% organic matter.
Did you say 12.5%?
12.5%, probably starting with corn fields that were like 2 or 3%.
Wow, that's like a pillow.
150% carbon. Well, but see that, and that's the result of the grazing. And that result is now we have three times the biomass.
Yeah.
It's healthy because its roots are down there 3 feet. The carbon is in that system functioning. The microbes are functioning. All the nutrients are coming up. It's just a remarkable system. And it happens, like I said, fast. So, you know, give you one of my little trademark talks. I tell people I could stop the flooding of the Mississippi, I could cure the drought in the West, and I could take a big whack at human obesity. All you have to do is give me the three states of Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana, those corn states and soy states mm-hmm. we're talking about. 97 to 100% of that land is planted to soy.
Mm-hmm.
That land is dead. It's biologically dead as a result of our monoculture poison spray. That system is defunct. In our breadbasket, that system doesn't work. So nobody's taking me up on it, but I'm positive I could change those environmental factors. You know, give you an example. If you go on our website, there's a video that deals with infiltration of water. So done by an NRCS guy, three different perk tests on corn land planted with no-till, the best practice, extensively grazed land the way they do it out west, let the cattle out all summer, and then this adaptive multi-paddock grazing. So does a little perk test. 30 minutes for the water to penetrate the corn land. So why does the Mississippi flood? The ground is like concrete. Water can't go in. Goes downstream. The extensively grazed land, dramatically better. 7 minutes to percolate. The adaptive multi-paddock, 10 seconds to infiltrate. So you want to get the water out of the air into the ground. Now, that soil is porous. The water goes in, and guess what grabs it? Carbon. Carbon holds 7 times its weight. It's a sponge. So if you did that on a three-state watershed scale, you would solve huge environmental problems. And this, what's remarkable is it's the system exists. It's proven by time. It works flawlessly. Every student in grade school learned about it. Photosynthesis. Photosynthesis, taking CO2 out of the air, changing into sugars, putting it down in the roots, way below the soil where it cannot reoxidize in a stable form. And then that carbon works wonders down below the soil there. Makes that, you know, makes the minerals and nutrients available back to the plant. So it's a very virtuous system. It's a system that doesn't, you know, we don't need a university to help us figure it out. It's just there. You have to manage it. But that's the system for getting carbon out of the air. It's the real low-hanging fruit. Get carbon out of the air, back in the ground. And it stabilizes our water cycle, our weather, and it will create jobs.
So that is, well, I'll ask this. So one of the issues that I think we've fallen into in this reductionist approach to agriculture is it's so vast, it's so big, right? And people have had to take sections, links of the chain out and define that as their expertise. So the result is we don't have any systems thinking approach to our food systems. It's figuring out how they can all then be stitched together thereafter. One thing I've seen and been interested by is in the regenerative space, regenerative agricultural space, is the systems thinking approach. And I think that is also correlating to where consumers seem to be headed with demands and asks of kind of a broad awakening, right? Understanding of where people are at, what their impact is. And like you said, vote with your dollars, right?
Absolutely.
Use your resources.
That's the key. I mean, I don't have much faith that policy, you know, budgets, USDA are going to fix this.
Yeah.
I think the customers could fix this in a heartbeat if they spent their money the right way.
So how do we engage those customers that you've taken 30, 40, 50 years of experience?
Right.
It's funny, I can say that when you're only 25 years old, huh?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But with all of this experience, it's second nature to you. You get this, no problem. And I think more people are engaged in that. You can break it down, and it's very simplistic in your mind. And I think you've done a nice job of being able to then explain that to a general audience where people aren't as aware of that. How do we bring it mainstream? What, in your perspective, where do we take this to get more engagement? Is it on the environmental side? Is it on the human health side? Is it on the sentient animal side? Or all of
it's,
it?
It's all of it together. And the key is for people to understand, you know, we live in our little bubbles, but if you look at agriculture in New England, okay, take dairy. Now, when I was, in 1974, I milked dairy cows in Central Mass. We were making $14 a hundredweight. Today, they're making $1,400 a hundredweight. When Agrimark sent the milk checks in February, they sent names of suicide prevention counselors. These farmers are desperate, and yet they have the land. They can't make any money. But as you said, I think I see this as an opportunity that we could put all that land back to work right here in River City, right here where we live, and we could change it in a heartbeat to productive, regenerative land. But it takes the customer understanding that when they go into their store, instead of buying that product, you know, rank on a couple of competitors, Dakota Organic. What do you think? From Australia. Not the Dakotas. But it says Product USA on it because of our laws. And if you go and ask a question, dig in and say, no, I want something grown in the USA. For starters, get something grown in the USA, then get something in the region. And that will impact, with dollars, the farmer, who then can buy a car and buy food, and paint their house.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really, it's hard when we live in this bubble, but if you drive through the rural areas of New England, Maine, the Champlain River Valley, Central New York, you see houses that are derelict, yeah. Public buildings are for sale, you know, houses that were beautiful houses built on an agricultural past are falling down. But that could be turned. I mean, we also at the same time have the markets of the world in Boston and New York. I mean, they are still the markets of the world. They've been since the U.S. started, the European colonization. and they still the market. And those markets can shift. But it's the whole, that's why we call our company Big Picture Beef, because it really is understanding the big picture as it's related to your food choices.
Yeah.
And it's really about grain. You know, we have a little motto, feed grain, kill soil. So a lot of people have lumped pork and chickens into the same as pasture. And I started with pork, so I understand it intimately. I had all the heritage breeds, organic certified, lived outside. But they only have one stomach. They got to have grain.
Yeah.
Chickens don't have they're not ruminants. They have to have grain.
Yeah.
So as soon as you have grain, it's grown somewhere else. Is it GMO? Is it, or maybe if it's non-GMO, but it's still sprayed with some poison.
Yeah.
So the grain system, the way we do it today, doesn't have to be, but the way we do it kills soil.
Yeah.
Whereas the beef is totally solar, totally regenerative if it's done right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a good message for consumers that it is, and meat, it's species specific. And,
absolutely.
You know, with beef, we really have an opportunity to make it a shallow supply chain. Like you said, photosynthesis is the cheapest way of growing food, and it's also the best for the animal, which is best for us.
And the soil.
That's right.
I mean, I haven't found the warts on the system yet.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, some of the others, like the pastured pork, I love the picture of the pig playing in the grass. But right outside the frame of the picture is the 2-ton feeder.
Yeah.
It's on all those farms.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
It is, and that maybe that's the word, is the lack of understanding and the lack of knowledge associated to the system.
I mean, everybody wants to do the right thing and embrace these terms. And that's part of the challenge, is certifications and what are they trying to tell us? Is it humane? Is it free range? Is it local? Is it, you know, all of those certifications are trying to tell us something. And it's very confusing for the customer to sort out.
That's right. I mean, if the industry is confused by it, the consumer is
absolutely
throws their hands up. And I think to your point earlier, as you mentioned, the country of origin labeling only adds more complexity to that, or more question of, you know, what is the impetus of what? And it makes people look for alternatives. And I think one of the things that you've been talking about, which is key to bring up here specifically for Big Picture Beef, is the idea of local or regional, really, is kind of looking at it from a financial model here of that opportunity. So let me just read a quick part of your bio here of what you described Big Picture Beef as and how that integrates into bioregions and regional instances. So we work with numerous, and this is your statement here, we work with numerous farms in the region that produce young stock according to our standards. Then we aggregate these cattle for fattening and on several large finishing farms also in the region that are staffed by skilled grazers. A variety of regenerative farming techniques, notably rotational grazing, fostering soil and healthy fertility, are key to success. We harvest the finished cattle and sell 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef and beef products to wholesale customers. And I think that last line's key here. And this is when you get into our precursor or preamble conversation, we talked about this. That's the nuance we're missing here. And is almost 90% of food still goes through wholesale distribution.
Exactly.
And what Australia has done very well is get themselves into wholesale distribution. And that's where we've been missing within our local food movement or farmers markets. So here's Big Picture Beef, who's coming in to alleviate that, using the opportunity that you mentioned, Boston and New York, where kind of this interesting culmination of forces, world economies come through here. We source only 6-7% of our own food systems, but we got a huge percentage of discretionary income and knowledge and people looking for more of this food. So here is a staple and anchor to get us there. So please tell us.
Yeah. Let me jump in on that, because the key word that puts some people off is aggregation.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've done the farmers markets. Now we've moved on to food hubs, all these different systems to try and know the local farmer. So when I learned to farm, I tell people I learned to farm in the 1800s because I learned to farm at Old Sturbridge Village. So we were trying to replicate the 1830s. We did a lot of research, and we knew that all these farmers, and most farmers had 100 acres and 4 or 5 cows. Okay, and most of the land was open at that time. 80% of the land was open in the 1830s. So no farmer was selling meat or milk to their neighbor. It wasn't happening. Everybody knew each other, but they weren't selling to each other. So what happened? How did the system work? Everybody milked the cows when the grass was green, and they made cheese and butter. They took the cheese and butter down to the general store, traded for the things they couldn't make, And the storekeeper was the original aggregator. He had a barrel. He put the cheese from all these small family farms into a barrel, put the barrel on an ox cart, and went where? To the market, Boston. So there's the aggregation model coming, and that segued eventually into the milk train. There used to be trains that came through the central part of Massachusetts, bringing milk to Boston. And you'd come down with your milk cans and throw them on the train. But that aggregation model is absolutely necessary in order to deal with these big customers. Like, I called Harvard University, and the young lady, the Insophone, just kind of laughed at me. She said, but we use 25,000 pounds of grass-fed beef. I said, no problem. Talk to me. I'm not one farm. I'm a whole bunch of farms.
Right.
So that's the key, is to retain the quality from the existing farms. And what's interesting in the beef business is it's already set up like this. There's all these small family farms. Average size herd is 20 to 30 head that produce the vast majority of the beef in the country.
Yeah.
So in our region, the Northeast, which we include Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and West Virginia, there's over 600,000 beef calves born every year right here. They get on a truck and go to the feedlots. So our system is to get in that relationship, keep those cattle here, influence the genetics with a good bull if we can, and then keep them here and put them on our finishing farm, process them here, and go to the markets that are here.
Mm.
But in terms of, local, it's a region. It's not like people always say, well, can I get beef from this town in Massachusetts? Well, for 1 week you can.
Yeah.
But not 52 weeks out of the year.
Right.
But I have some that's from this town right over here, not too far away, raised under the same system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of the aggregation model. And people, I feel people, need to get comfortable with that, because that's really the key to getting enough volume to deal with a market. And the wholesale market, our target is customers like Big Y's, a 70-store chain. We're in all 70 stores every week, again and again and again. And the customer who might go to the farmer's market and buy something once in a while, but they go in there every week to get their staples, and there's our product.
Yeah.
So that's kind of our idea, is to deal with these existing systems of distribution, logistics, and stores that are in the business.
Yeah. Have you ever done the math to figure out if the 600,000 beef cattle animals that were born within the Northeast, how would that mesh with demand? Have you ever broken that down?
It's a very small percentage of the beef consumed in the U.S. in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Very small percentage. So it seems like a big number, but it's very small.
Yeah. So we got a lot of opportunity to move in that direction.
It's an immense opportunity. And then if you look at the opportunity of the land, all these dairy farms that are going out.
Yeah.
That have most of them amassed a big chunk of land, 1,000 acres.
Yeah.
And if they would switch, it's just the potential is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And what's exciting about those dairy farmers is that these are people that understand land, cattle, tractors. And what we would actually do is recommend they plant a cocktail cover crop, like 8 different species, and it's grass, and we would graze it. And we can get gains equivalent to feedlot gains on that kind of cover crop. Transition the land to back to the good soil, perennial grass.
And so that cover crop is a balanced diet for a ruminant, right? I mean, you've got, everyone thinks it's just the grass blades, but they eat many forbs.
Absolutely. We put some turnips. We put radishes. We'd put, rye, oats, all kinds of things. Back to your question about where you think I think that one of the big things that needs to happen is to talk to people who have an environmental kind of perspective. And actually, Big Picture Beef is just entering into a partnership with Soil for Climate.
Yeah.
Those guys.
Yeah, great.
Who are very much into the grazing as a solution from the environmental point of view, and us, bringing the cattle. But we think that's, a platform that we need to talk to people, that if you really want to do the right thing for the world, buy this beef and eat it, because it really is, it's a solution.
Yeah.
It's not the problem, and the environmentalists, a lot of environmentalists have really aligned on the side of the beef is the problem. Well, I agree that 90% of the beef in this country is the problem, but the solution is in grazing cattle this way, and we can change all those problems of the conventional system. We can get rid of the feedlot, we can get rid of nutrients, we can get rid of grain, we can get rid of trucks. You know, there's so many things that we can eliminate right here in River City. But we have to have that pull on the rope.
Yeah.
That's the key.
As Alan Savory said, it's the management, not the animal. Right?
Absolutely.
More animals, it seems we're finally learning, or at least we're getting to the point of appreciation. And maybe that, as you mentioned, the mechanism that's going to get us there of using the consumer as the change agent is empowering them. So putting on the label on the meat that you sell, that this saves the planet. This is an opportunity for you to partake in something where you can vote with your dollars.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Ridge, where can we learn more about Big Picture Beef?
Well, our website's excellent in terms of, it has a lot of these stories, a lot of this deep background, and it references studies. So a lot of this, a lot of people have said, there's no research. But the research has been done. Richard Teague, Texas A&M, yeah. His articles are on the website. And he has done this research in Texas, Missouri, and Canada. He just was given $2.5 million by the government of Canada to do the research. And he was just given $6 million by McDonald Corporation to continue the research. So people have got their ear to the ground. This putting carbon down by grazing right is a fact. Peer-reviewed studies. You know, there's a lot of people who give Alan Savory flack because there's no studies. But the studies have been done here in this country, and we know it works.
Yeah.
So there's those facts, and so people can really embrace it. But you can find that kind of information on our website, and then there's links to these articles. If you really want to dig,
it's plenty of empirical evidence to prove this too, right? From desertification is proven,
absolutely.
And you can see that within a
generation. What's fascinating is that the desertification, which is where Savory spent a lot of his time in brittle environments, but we are in a non-brittle environment.
Yeah, and look
and
what
it's
we're doing.
It happens dramatically fast. You know, it's funny. I had a meeting in New York City with Bill Nyman from Nyman Ranch and Matt from Blue Apron. And after about 4 or 5 hours, Bill said to me, he said, Rich, you know, for a Yankee, you know an awful lot about cattle. And I said, well, I'll take that as a compliment. But he said, you can't raise cattle out here. You got to raise it out where cattle are. I said, wait, Bill. How many acres does it take to support a cow in your environment?
Yeah.
15 to 20 acres.
Yeah.
Here, one or two. So we have water. And then I said, the real kicker, Bill, who's close to the market? He says, you got me. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the opportunity is immense, but it's hard. It's not easy, or everybody would have done it. I mean, we have small fields, you know, multiple ownership, you know, all those stone walls, trees, all those things.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we have tremendous opportunity to do it right here. But it won't work through subsidies and grants and outside money. It will work beautifully if people will buy spend the dollars.
We had Bill on the show to talk about local versus locale, and I think your point is well taken, that idea of locale can also represent other facets, not just the land that you're working on or proximity or total size, but when you have good quality soils that can retain the water you need and grow veg that you need and put higher density on animals and reach those markets you needed. That does create it. And again, if we look at the game theory, to your point earlier, we got some great land that's being put under stress and distressed dairies at this point. Well, let's start here with some better beef production and getting our animals out on open pasture. So, and Ridge, one last question. So you on your website, will our listeners be able to find the Time Magazine article, which I found quite interesting, from 2010, the original carbon cowboy, they defined you as. 2010, Time special report, they earmark a whole article dedicated to you on regenerative best practices. Can we find that story?
It should be on there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, those links should be on there. Yeah.
Very good. All right. So, Ridge, so looking at this as an expert in authentic agriculture, you said 1800s, we'll call it authentic agriculture, right? Where we've got the ability, we've learned this ability for taking the cattle, grass feeding them, fattening and marbleizing properly, regional production, and then getting the key element there of bringing that to distribution within wholesale and preserving those values all the way through the supply chain seems to be something that Big Picture is absolutely focused on. And looking at that opportunity of taking the 600,000 potential animals in the Northeast and bringing it to market share, well, that only scratches the surface. Well, this is a good potential jobs creator for folks that want to get into agriculture, that care Absolutely. About the land, care about the environment. And if it is a situation where we've got less than 1% of total beef consumed in this country being grass-fed, or grass-fed from this from domestic grass-fed, wow, that's an opportunity for empowerment for more consumers.
Yeah, and Forbes says that within 8 years, 30% of all beef consumed in this country will be grass-fed.
Oh, interesting.
It's an immense, immense opportunity.
Quite a hockey stick. So, yes, there's a big change in what can create. And to your point earlier about chasing the fat, I think that anthropology actually would agree with you. If you look at the Inuit population and what they lived on, or what we did with fishing the commons with whales and our search for fats, right. Boy, all history should show that we weren't looking for lean meat. We were actually looking for something that would sustain us over a long period of time. Seems to be,
empirical
evidence.
The fat correlates to the brain. You know, I mean, if you get right back to it, essential fatty acids are critical. Your brain doesn't function without them.
Yeah.
So there it is.
So I'll empower our listeners to take the opportunity that Ridge set for us, Ridge's challenge here of giving them the three states in central U.S. and get rid of all the water supply coming from the Ogallala, and let's commit to regenerative best practices of getting animal back on land and investing in soil qualities, sequestering of carbon, and really a holistic and cyclical and circular approach to food systems. So, Ridge, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today. It was a great conversation.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
If anybody's got a place where they want to be talked to about this, call me up.
Fantastic.
That's really my job now. I know how to do all this other stuff, but talking to people is the whole game.
It is. Yeah.
It really is.
Well, very good. Ridge, thank you very much. And until next time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.